Good evening. You're listening to the Parliament of Rooks podcast, episode 28, when the carnival is over.
Say goodbye, my own true lover, as we sing a lover's song. How it breaks my heart to leave you. Now the carnival is gone.
So welcome back, everyone, to the Parliament of Rooks podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Lanise.
And this is his co-host, Melanie Lanise.
You're just my co-host this week. You're not no longer my wife.
This is his co-host and wife, Melanie Lanise.
That's better. No, that's just true.
Don't you forget it.
So first things first, we both, you know, want to apologize for the lateness of this episode. I'm assuming we're going to be late. Like, you know, I guess, you know, there's like a 10% chance I think we're still going to get this out on Monday, but I'm looking at the clock and, you know,
just, yeah, probably not.
Thinking about the editing that we got ahead of us. Yeah, I don't think we're going to make it. You know, when we first started out, I think initially back in January, we were aiming for like Saturday weekly release, and then mm-hmm. that got pushed to Sunday, and then you know, with Lash's funeral or whatever, we then wound up on Monday. So that being said, you know, at least the circumstances behind, you know, this lateness are, you know, somewhat more positive. Mm-hmm. This past weekend, you know, I guess current weekend or whatever, but by the time this gets out, past weekend, our little town that we live, you know, outside of is, I think I've mentioned this before on the show, home to a one of, let's say, you know, 50 different festivals that they run throughout the year.
Yeah, we're kind of kitschy.
Like, like every 2 weeks they got, you know, like a parade or, you know, a festival or whatever where they shut down the main street for different reasons. And this past weekend is what I'd say is probably the second biggest festival, would you say?
Yes, yeah,
that's probably the first one would be the Firebird Festival, right?
Right, in the winter.
Yeah, they have on the winter solstice. You know, our town builds this, like, gigundous, you know, wooden phoenix, and then the whole town comes around and they burn it to the ground, yeah, and then they, you know, rebuild it for the next year, sort of like, you know, a annual type thing. Mm-hmm. But this past weekend, I guess, is our biggest, I guess you'd call it Summer Festival. I've mentioned before on the show that, you know, our little town's, you know, claim to fame is, it's one of the towns that the movie, the Blob, you know, from an old, Steve McQueen movie from the 50s, mm-hmm. Was filmed, you know, in parts of our town. And so every summer they close down the main street and we have Blob Fest, you know, which is basically like a big, big like sci-fi festival. I think, you know, they reenact the big scene from The Blob where everybody runs out of our local theater. You know, it's a very, very cool theater, the Colonial. It's, mm-hmm. it's actually like one of those old-fashioned theaters with the balconies and all that. And that's where the movie was actually filmed. And then, like I say, you know, all down up and down the streets, you know, you have little vendors with, you know, like T-shirts. And like, it's not just limited to the movie. It's all like forms of kitsch, you know, like comic books and like posters, mm-hmm. and like, yep. you know, TV show type things, little Aurora models we saw.
Yeah, that was cool.
So we tied it right into, you know, our show. So yeah, so we had a good time. But accordingly, you know, our normal recording time was, you know, sort of superseded. So apologies to everybody who was looking up for our, you know, our wrap up of the Silver Age. So welcome, you know, to that, and welcome to our final episode.
Of
the Silver Age. Yeah. Oh, you ruined my joke. I know that's like setting it up for, you know, for a punchline.
No, I'm sorry.
But yes, like we mentioned a couple times, you know, our Silver Age is sort of winding down. And not to, you know, bury the lead, but we've decided, Melanie and I, we've been talking about it. And we were thinking that we actually are going to go on a bit of a hiatus, you know, for the summer. You know, just take a couple months break or whatever, you know, retool the show a bit, you know, work on our plan for the next wave, you know, for the beginning of the bronze, and, you know, come back, you know, right at probably the beginning of autumn. I'm thinking like early September, you know, not too late. So maybe take like, you know, a 6 to 8 week break here. And accordingly, you know, what we have is, you know, sort of a nice, I would call it almost like a volume. Like I've been thinking about it and, you don't know this, but, back in the day, you know, how, like, we've been taking a look at the comic books and they have, like, numbering systems, you know, like, issue one comes out and then 2, 3, like, you know, obvious whatever. But these get up to, like, you know, issue 60, 70, 80. Back in the day, you know, when they first started, it wasn't like that. What they would have is what's called volumes. Mm-hmm. They would start, like, so let's say, you know, your first issue was in January. So you'd have volume one, issue one, and then February would be volume one, issue two, so on and so forth, all the way to volume one, issue 12. And then next January, it'd be volume two, issue one. Huh. So we're not going to do that for this show. We're not going to start the Bronze Age with, you know, volume two, episode one or whatever. But, you know, I guess like metaphorically, it's kind of similar. Or like if you want to put it into a different metaphor, almost like a TV season. Mm-hmm. You know, we're leaving it on, you know, a conclusion, and when we start it, it's going to be a different flavor, you know, something like The Wire or something like that. So, but like I say, you know, it feels like, you know, the material that we've covered acts as a self-contained unit.
Mm-hmm.
When we started out, you know, we sort of, you know, set basic goals of, you know, things we wanted to cover. I wanted to introduce you to the you know, convention of the comics, you know, like, mm-hmm. first and foremost, you know, how do you read these things? You know, what's a splash panel? How does the cover act? You know, panel to panel, how do you follow the flow and all that? And, you know, that seemed pretty easy for you. You know,
yeah,
it doesn't take a rocket scientist to read a comic book. but then additionally, you know, because the era we were looking at, you know, didn't have that much, you know, interconnectivity between these stories.
Right.
I think I said, you know, at one point that I wanted to basically create a narrative between these variant threads. And so, you know, with the subgenre of magic that we looked at, I feel, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I almost feel as though there was, you know, three different streams of input into what we were covering. And, you know, very loosely, I think that might even correspond to, you know, the editorial lines that, you know, we've talked about from time to time. The first one, you know, and not necessarily chronological in the order that we covered, but just, you know, I guess thematically, you know, mm-hmm. would be like the humor line.
Like Stanley and his monster.
Stanley and his monster, yeah. But all the, you know, titles that, you know, had editorial purview by Murray Boltonoff. You might not remember this name, but, you know, originally all that stuff was handled by a guy, Larry Nadel. But when he passed away, Murray Boltonoff came on and took over, you know, control of that. But then also the things that we talked about but didn't necessarily look at, you know, the Jerry Lewis and Bob Hope mm-hmm. and all that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was one form of input. Those didn't really intersect that much, you know, with the main body of DC. Like occasionally there would be, you know, guest appearances in Jerry Lewis by, like, you know, Superman or Batman. We even saw the ad
right,
for Batman or whatever. But that's almost like, you know, almost a parody type thing. You could say that that didn't take place in, you know, DC Universe proper. And Stanley and his monster, although later on, you know, much, much later on, that would tie into like a Green Arrow story written by Kevin Smith, believe it or not.
Huh.
But like at the time, you know, it was just a thing of its own. Like there'd be little nods, like you'd see, you know, his dad was reading the Daily Planet or something like that.
Right, right.
But for the most part, you know, that particular stream we used as kind of like almost a break, you know, like when things got too heavy or whatever, hey, let's have a Stanley and his monster episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So the second, you know, narrative thread that, you know, I perceive or whatever, but once again, feel free to interject here if, you know, you don't feel the same, would be those sort of like weird titles that we took a look at, you know, under the editorial ownership of Jack Schiff.
Mm-hmm.
We talked initially, Jack Schiff, you know, had oversight over Batman, but then like when New Look came in, they took him off that, you know, and got rid of all the aliens and whatever. Well, Jack Schiff then, you know, became the editor, you know, for the line of like House of Secrets, House of Mystery. You know, and that's where like characters like, you know, Mark Merlin
right,
and
yeah.
his transformation into Ra-Man and, you know, Eclipso and the Enchantress, you know, that's where like, you know, Strange Adventures, right, was another title under him. But that's, you know, where all those type characters were. And that's kind of like a middle ground almost. And that's why I'm saying this is the second, you know, narrative stream,
mm-hmm.
because those characters for the most part kind of existed in their own little corner of the DCU. But there were crossovers, right? We saw, you know, Ra-Man hook up with Eclipso when they were trying to, like, you know, marry,
right.
you know, that the two characters of that book. But then Eclipso himself, you know, had a crossover in Brave and the Bold, you know, with Batman. And they even referenced, you know, Prince Ra-Man in that. Now, admittedly, you know, that was all under the, you know, pen of Bob Haney. So, you know, he was like sort of, you know, creating his own, you know, little corner of the DCU.
Right. So Earth B rules apply.
Earth B. Exactly. You know, but that, you know, is the launching pad, I think, you know, for the third narrative stream, you know, that we talked about, and the one that had, you know, probably the lion's share of everything we covered, you know, and that being the superhero lines.
Right.
You know, basically with JLA, Justice League, you know, acting as the hub, you know, that is what spun out to all of our other, you know, like sort of, you know, magic related characters that we covered here. You know, we saw the introduction of magic in JLA with, you know, villains like, you know, the Demons 3 and Felix Faust and right. all that. And then JLA, you know, was the launching pad for the revival of a lot of those Golden Age characters.
JSA.
For the JSA, exactly. You know, Dr. Fate, that's where he came in. Johnny Thunder, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we saw him there, and we covered, you know, you talk about humor, you know, we covered a little bit of his, you know, quote unquote, you know, humorous
humor.
Stuff from the Golden Age. Spectre, you know, Spectre first appeared, you know, reappeared, I should say, you know, in Showcase, but in very short order, you know, he was in the JLA. And then another character, you know, that had interlocking story, I guess you'd say, with JSA would be Zatanna, mm-hmm. who is slightly different. You know, that's not a revival, you know, in the true sense, you know, like, you know, Dr. Fate or Spectre or whatever. But she was the first legacy character we saw, you know, the inheritor, you know, if you will, of Zatara's power. Exactly. And all of these things, you know, Zatanna and the JSA revivals and Showcase and, like, mm-hmm. the JLA stories themselves, they too, you know, fell under a single editorial owner, you know, that being Julia Schwartz.
Who I've heard of.
Who you've heard of, right? The reason you heard him is because, you know, he was partnered, I would say, partnered, whatever. He, you know, for the stories we read, you know, worked almost exclusively with Gardner Fox. Mm-hmm. So anytime it was a Gardner Fox story, it was a Julia Schwartz edited story.
Ah.
So as I mentioned, you know, I think in the past couple episodes or whatever, you know, as we're wrapping up the Silver Age, I kind of want to do due diligence, you know, spotlighting each of these creators. So I can think of no better person, you know, as we're doing our final Silver Age episode to talk about than Julia Schwartz himself.
Okay, great.
All right. So Julia Schwartz, you know, similar to, you know, most of the creators we've looked at, you know, with the exception of Mike Sikowski that we just learned, you know, was born in Lancaster. And while I was doing my research for this, you know, another one that we actually didn't do a full spotlight, we talked about a little, was Murphy Anderson,
mm-hmm.
who, believe it or not, was actually from Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, as you know, for the benefit of our listeners, that's Melanie and I's like favorite place in America. So yeah, but like I say, everybody else, you know, came from New York, and Julia Schwartz was no exception. He was born in June of 1915 in the Bronx to a family of you know, Romanian immigrants. He you know, went to high school locally there at a high school called Theodore Roosevelt High School, graduating when he was 17, and right out of high school, and this is something we definitely have talked about when we were doing our spotlight on Mort Weisinger.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, always a fan of, you know, sci-fi and things like that, you know, growing up. He immediately hooked up, you know, with similar-minded folks, you know, Mort Weisinger himself, and then, you know, mm-hmm. Forrest J. Ackerman that we talked about before, you know, the father of fandom, you know, with
right.
the famous Monsters of Filmland. And that trio, you know, formed the first, you know, major fanzine that we've mentioned before in mm-hmm. relationship to Mort, The Time Traveler. And also, as we mentioned, you know, when covering Weisinger, you know, in 1934, the two of them broke off, you know, forming their little, you know, literary agency, you know, representing all those famous sci-fi writers.
Right.
You know, Robert Bloch and Alfred Bester, Ray Bradbury, H.P. Lovecraft, you know, basically just covering, you know, the entire genre, you know, of the time. Dissimilar, however, though, to Mort Weisinger, who, you know, left the literary agency to go work in the pulps. Julia Schwartz went directly to work for comics.
Mm-hmm.
And you may or may not remember this, but you remember how I was saying that DC Comics, you know, in the Golden Age was kind of like two companies? You know, there was like National that handled like Superman and Batman and all that. But then there was also, you know, All American Comics, which was headed up by, you know, the fellow Max Gaines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Julia Schwartz, you know, was working on the All American side. Initially, you know, for Flash Comics and All American, but in very short order, you know, began expanding out. He handled, you know, All-Star Comics, where the JSA appeared, you know,
right.
the latter day. And then also Green Lantern, notable for the fact that Julia Schwartz was directly responsible for bringing in the primary writer of the Golden Age Green Lantern, Alfred Bester, who he had recruited from his literary agent days. That was one of the sci-fi writers that, uh-huh. you know, he had brokered stories for. So yeah, so Julia Schwartz, you know, throughout the late Golden Age, you know, did a lot of superhero stuff. But, you know, as we've talked about before, you know, that was very slowly beginning to wane, you know, at the end of the 40s, you know, post-World War II. A lot of other genres were coming to primacy, you know, humor and, you know, in particular, Western, you know, is mm-hmm. where Julia Schwartz began focusing. A couple of those titles that he'd worked on that, you know, formerly had been superhero books, you know, All-Star and All-American, or were actually converted to become Western. So like All-Star Comics, you know, became All-Star Western. Matter of fact, I think at the very, very beginning of our show,
yeah.
I told this story about Roy Thomas.
Right.
Yeah, we had the subscription. Yeah, so, but another title like that would have been All-American Comics, where GL, you know, Green Lantern was appearing, that became All-American Western. I want to say, don't quote me on this, but I want to say that All-American Western was where a cowboy version of Johnny Thunder appeared. Okay, I'm not saying, no, not with a thunderbolt, not humorous or whatever, just a gunslinger happened to be called Johnny Thunder. Like, they immediately recycled the name for, like, a cowboy guy. Yeah, so it's kind of funny. There was also Western Comics, but then some of those hybrid things we talked about, like, you know, when they had romance comics,
mm-hmm.
there was actually a comic called Romance Trail that Julia Schwartz, you know, oversaw. And then some of those licensed things. Jimmy Wakely was a Hollywood cowboy hero, you know, kind of lost to the ages or whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, he was a Gene Autry type, or, you know, know, like Roy Rogers, that type thing. So yeah, Julius Schwartz, you know, oversaw that as well. But, you know, as the Golden Age died out, we too have talked about, you know, that interim period, you know, the Atomic Age.
Right.
Right. And that, you know, is where Julius Schwartz really, 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 in my opinion, and I imagine most people's opinion, began to shine, because sci-fi was really, you know, his roots. Mm-hmm. You know, all throughout his childhood, that's what he was a fan of. You know, he set up that that fanzine, The Time Traveler.
Right.
And yeah, and the title we talked about a couple episodes back when we were doing the Enchantress, Strange Adventures. In August of 1950, you know, Julius Schwartz was there helming, you know, the initial issue of that. And that, probably more so than, you know, any other title, was really a showcase for a lot of the writers and artists that we've seen here on our show. You know, that's where they got their start, you know, under, you know, Julius Schwartz's tutelage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, guys like Carmine Infantino, mm-hmm. You know, the writer John Broome, certainly Gardner Fox, Murphy Anderson, you know, forget about it. You know, he did the Atomic Knights and all that. Mike Sikowski, you know, mm-hmm. we talked about, you know, just last issue or whatever, also, you know, got his start in Strange Adventures. And it wasn't limited to just that title. There was also a sister title, Mystery in Space. You know, we've occasionally seen reference to that.
Right.
That Julius Schwartz also oversaw. So, you know, these two were sort of, you know, anthology sci-fi titles that for the most part, you know, all these creators, you know, did a lot of cool stuff in. Let's see. Throughout the 50s, he had a few things of note. Worked on a couple more licensed things. Hopalong Cassidy. Big Town, which was kind of like I want to say a radio adaptation that used to be like a radio show, and they brought it over to be a comic book. The Adventures of Rex the Wonder Dog, we talked before. Remember, it's going to be your spinoff podcast. and one other thing, you know, that very, very, very early on, you know, we saw a couple of the covers for it here. We didn't actually go into any of the stories, but when we get into our Bronze Age coverage, we probably will loop back around to this, is The Phantom Stranger. Only ran for 6 issues in the 1950s, but that too was a Julius Schwartz title. Mm-hmm. Sort of a mysterious guy, you know, involved in like some, you know, spooky stuff. But it was right before the code hit, so I think they canceled that in short order. But everything changed, you know, the entire comics landscape, let's say, you know, changed with the advent of Showcase magazine. Mm-hmm. You know, now that, I don't think we've talked about, you know, the editorial niceties of Showcase, but basically, because it was a spotlight title for, you know, different concepts, the editorial oversight of that magazine was sort of on a rotation, I guess you'd say. Like, you know, you'd see, you know, like Bob Kaniger, you know, would come in and you know, oversee some of them, or like Jack Schiff or whatever, you know, would oversee some of them. So every 3 or 4 issues, there'd be like a different editor for that specific feature.
Mm-hmm.
But I think nobody can deny that, you know, probably one of the biggest features, you know, ever to appear in Showcase, you know, would be The Flash.
Mm,
and that, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, I think, you know, is a fair mark to say, you know, kicked off the Silver Age. You know, you can debate whether or not you say that the Martian Manhunter, you know, and Detective, you know, preceded that a little bit. Some people even take it back as far as, you know, Captain Comet, but he's more like, I think, you know, probably assigned to that interim Atomic Age. But yeah, absolutely, you know, Showcase number 4, September 56, first appearance of The Flash, and that, you know, brainchild of Julius Schwartz, and really kicked off the whole reinvention of those Golden Age characters and, you know, and providing them to a new generation. And in doing so, you know, updating them, you know, with a sci-fi background.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked, you know, I think just in the last handful of episodes or whatever, about another sci-fi concept, you know, that was near and dear to Julius Schwartz's heart, you know, the character Adam Strange. Remember mm-hmm. the guy I told you about who could zap by that beam and like transport it to another planet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was actually born out of an editorial mandate by a publisher at the time, Erwin Donenfeld. And this is really going back, so you might not remember us talking about this, but remember I was saying that Erwin Donenfeld, you know, noticed a trend in cinema about, you know, sci-fi, like all the sort of, you know, aliens from outer space and all mm-hmm. that? Yeah, so he is the one who sort of came in as like, I want to see that in my comics, and that's kind of where Batman went off the rails. It was as part of this uh-huh. You know, edict, but some of the good things that came out of it, you know, was a mandate that he gave to both Jack Schiff and Julius Schwartz. He's like, I want to see 2 space-based heroes. I want each one of you to invent it. I want one from the present and one from the future. And so they kind of talked among each other, and Jack Schiff, you know, picked the one from the future. And I mentioned before, you know, the character that was born out of that was a Space Ranger,
mm-hmm.
kind of like, you know, out in outer space and just, you know, your stereotypical adventures. But Julius Schwartz, you know, was like, you know what? If I make him in the present, that's actually even more relatable. And that's where Adam Strange came out of.
Ah.
Yeah. So that would have been Showcase number 17 from November 58, And only 1 year later, Julius Schwartz would launch his second, you know, Silver Age revival of a Golden Age character in Showcase number 22. That would be Green Lantern. Hmm. And that's the Hal Jordan version we know from, like, you know, New Frontier and, mm-hmm. and things like that. And that was just the beginning, you know, because both those concepts, you know, were rapidly, you know, absorbed by the fans, you know, they just kept the ball rolling, you know, Gardner Fox on the writing chores and Julius Schwartz as, you know, sort of idea man. They revived, you know, the concept of JLA. We talked before in Brave and the Bold. Mm-hmm. That would have been from February of 1960. Interesting story. I actually just read about why it's called the Justice League as opposed to, you know, the Silver Age Justice Society.
Why is that?
So around that time, that's when they were, you know, Major League Baseball was introducing the concept of the National League and the American uh-huh. League.
Yeah.
And Julius Schwartz is like, you know, I like the sound of that word league. And he's like, it's called the Justice League. So yeah, that was his idea. And so yeah, that would have been Brave and the Bold 28. And let's see, what else did he create? A couple months later, in May of 1960, in Flash number 112, introduced as a, you know, sort of featured character, you know, in a Flash story, but then in very short order spun out into his own little series, would be the Elongated Man.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, probably huge concept, you know, for our show and comics in general, you know, DC Comics in particular, you know, the concept of the multiverse. Was spawned in the same magazine, Flash number 123, for September of 61. And that's the story that we have read offline, you know, that being Flash of Two Worlds.
A good one.
You like them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, awesome. So yeah, that was a big thing. And then let's see what else. Oh, he did a revival, you know, we've talked a little bit of Hawkman. That occurred in Brave and the Bold, number 34. That would have been from February of 61. And Brave and the Bold, you know, similar to Showcase as far as, like, you know, a launching pad, but they actually began a sort of standard rotation for a time. Like, you know, Showcase would do, like, two or three issues of a character. Brave and the Bold actually, you know, would rotate, like, on a cycle between Hawkman and a couple other creations, Suicide Squad, which I know you've seen the previews for that
yep.
movie, and then a guy called Cave Carson, which... we haven't seen here, but we may see in the future when we get around to the forgotten heroes I mentioned before. He's like kind of like an underground spelunker, but he always has like adventures there. Like he meets monsters and stuff, you know, beneath
in the caves.
In the caves, exactly. It's kind of neat. Let's see. On the Showcase side, you know, in September of 61, he did another Golden Age to Silver Age conversion, you mm-hmm. know, with the Atom, who appeared in Showcase number 34. Let's see. Back in Brave and the Bold in 1963, he actually oversaw a... featured by Carmen Infantino that I'm quite fond of, but I think might be a little bit, you know, lost to the ages. It's a series called Strange Sports Stories. Like, it sounds a little, like, goofy or whatever, but basically it was a sci-fi feature, you know, that used sports as like a frame. So like, you know, there might be, like, you know, a baseball team where suddenly aliens come down and, like, challenge the baseball team to, like, play against them. Or there might be, like, a football player who gets, like, you know, hit by a science beam and now can run super fast. So do you see what I'm saying? Like, they're like sports stories, but, you know, with that sci-fi twist. And so, of course, like, Julius Schwartz, like, loved that.
It's all over it.
Yeah. And I wish they would do, maybe they have done a collection. I got to check that out. Because, like, one of the neat little artistic things they do is Carmine used that as a, like, almost an experimental proving ground for a different style where he would use, like, silhouettes to tell the story. So he would, like, do, you know, your standard comic panel, but then the next panel would be a metaphoric, you know, silhouette of one of those characters. I'm not doing this justice. I got to show it to you. It's
okay.
It's actually very, very, very cool. And speaking of cool things, you know, we talked before about, you know, Flash of Two Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, Julius Schwartz, you know, saw the huge success with, you know, having these crossovers between, you know, Earth
right.
1 and Earth 2, brought that back to JLA. And, you know, as we saw here, you know, in June of 63, you know, Justice League of America number 21 was the very first, you know, Earth 2 crossover.
Huh.
And that, you know, was so popular that spawned, you know, all those revivals that we've seen before. You know, Showcase 55 from March of 65, you know, was the return of Dr. Fate, you know, his team ups with your favorite, I know, Hourman, right? And then offline, you know, we took a look later that year in Brave and the Bold, you know, the team ups of Starman and Black Canary. And then, you know, not so much a team up, you know, but just the revival in Showcase number 61, March 66, of the Spectre. All of these things, you know, basically at the impetus of Julius Schwartz, you know, basically just covering a lot of bases.
Yeah.
We've talked before, you know, one of the other bases, you know, he was covering was, you know, the reinvention, you know, of Batman. you know, as that sci-fi impetus of Erwin Donenfeld, you know, proved not to be what was drawing readers in.
Mm-hmm.
Julia Schwartz, you know, was the architect, you know, of basically reinventing Batman with that whole new look, you know, in the advent of Batmania. And, you know, he pulled on, you know, old reliable Carmine Infantino paired with Joe Giella. And that, like I mentioned before, is, you know, some of my all-time favorite, you know, Silver Age art.
Yes.
Also, on the Batman front, you know, as we're beginning to get into the Bronze Age, Julius Schwartz is going to be, you know, overseeing those titles when two of the probably most seminal creators, you know, of the Bronze Age, you know, come into play. I might have mentioned these names before, but like I say, in our next wave, they're going to become super important. The writer Denny O'Neill and the artist slash writer Neil Adams took over Batman, and like I say, you know, basically set the model for what Batman would become in the modern age, you know, the sort of like Dark Knight detective, you know, that was really under this creative team, but once again, as I say, under the editorial oversight of Julius Schwartz. As the Bronze Age, you know, continues on, you know, we'll see in the early 70s, Julius Schwartz is going to be also responsible, you know, for revamping Superman, you know, similar to what he did for Batman. He sort of, you know, kicking and screaming, took the, you know, Weisingerial, you know, cliches and stuff,
right,
and sort of brought him into a modern age. He kicked off a story in January of 1971 in Superman 233 that's come to be known as Superman Breaks Loose. And what it is really kind of neat. Something happens, like, you know, a meteor hits or like a way, I forget the actual niceties, but in some way, all of the kryptonite on Earth suddenly turns to lead. So there's like nothing that like, you know,
can
stop Superman, except in this accident, this thing is born. And my gosh, it's going to sound goofy to you, but if you read the stories, it's actually, you know, quite like intense. A reflection of Superman is somehow born out of sand. Okay. So it becomes like almost like a Superman shaped sand monster that little by little begins looking more and more like Superman, you know, and as it does so, what it's doing is basically pulling Superman's power. So as it becomes stronger, Superman becomes weaker. Yeah. And so I'm not going to give away, you know, we may read this or whatever, but, you know, I'm not going to give away the twist, but long story short, when this thing is finally gone and, you know, vanquished or whatever, Superman is no longer as powerful as he once was. So, like, you know, the guy who could push planets and, like, you know, fly the speed of light, that's gone. So, you know, what you have is basically a more human Superman, similar to how, you know, he created a more human Batman. Yeah, it's very, very cool. Let's see, as time goes on, you know, throughout the 70s, you know, Julius Schwartz oversees the advent of another Superman title, DC Comics Presents, which is basically, it does for Superman what Brave and the Bold did for Batman. It basically becomes a team-up title, you know, where all the different heroes of the DCU, you know, get their turn, you know, teaming up with Superman on different adventures. Very, very cool title, and we will take a look at it because the backup feature in that I've mentioned before is Whatever Happened To. So we'll get to read some stories there about, like, whatever happened to Prince Rahman, for instance.
Oh.
Yeah, right. We'll see that.
What did happen to Prince Rahman?
We'll see the return of Mark Merlin, perhaps. DC Comics Presents. I'm not sure whether that is the longest editorial run that that Julius Schwartz had. You know, he may have been longer, you know, in Superman or Action or something, but, you know, definitely a long run. You know, he basically, you know, was with that title from its outset through full 97 issues, the entire run.
That's
of
huge.
That. Yeah, yeah. He was the editor for. Let's see. Also during that time, you know, going back to the 70s, let's see, he oversaw the integration of Captain Marvel, you know, Shazam, mm-hmm. you know, into DC Comics. That would have been from February of 73. June of 74, you know, to complete the troika, you know, he'd already, you know, reinvented Batman and Superman.
Right.
With Wonder Woman number 212. He basically reinvented Wonder Woman.
Hey, nice.
Yeah, very, very good run there. There's a classic story called the 12 Labors of Wonder Woman, basically narrated by a member of the Justice League. So you, like, you know, you pull, like, let's say Wonder Woman 212, and it's like Superman's like, and here's what Wonder Woman did, da-da-da-da-da, and then the next one would be Batman with the same, and then, like, Flash and Green Lantern, and all the way through, you know, all 12 issues. So it's a really nice sort of, like, you know, narrative framing device. You know,
nice.
Things like, yeah. Let's see, what else? In the late 70s, he returns, you know, to do editorial chores for Flash and Green Lantern. I think he had left that in the early 70s to other editors, you know, but, you know, he returns to both those titles. But then throughout the 80s, he becomes almost exclusively, I'd say, a Superman editor. You know, he had editorial chores over Superman, Action Comics, you know, which is the other, you know, featured title where Superman was appearing. DC Comics Presents, you know, we already mentioned, was the team-up title. But then another title that would debut in the early 80s called the New Adventures of Superboy. You know, he was the initial editor of that. And then a title that, not so much a title, it appeared in a series of miniseries, but one of my all-time favorite humor comics. Like, some of the humor that we've looked at here is, you know, cute if it comes to Stanley's Monster, or, like, you know, groany if it comes to, like, you know, Johnny Thunder. Mm. Preeminent, you know, humor title is something called Ambush Bug, which just... it's parody mixed with satire, mixed with, like, you know, just ripping apart the conventions of the DCU. And it's, and one of the neat things about it is the writer and an artist team, you know, was very sort of close to Julius Schwartz. Like, they, you know, he's a very sort of endearing character. You know, we've mentioned before, you know, how Mort Weisinger was sort of, you know, a bit of a tyrant. Julius Schwartz was not the exact opposite of that. You definitely wanted guys to adhere to deadlines, but he was really a more artistically open-minded fellow, you know, a lot of, like, collaboration with his writers, a lot of collaboration with his artists.
My impression is that he was like cherished by his workers.
Cherished, I don't know, that may be a little bit of a strong word, but he was definitely, like, you know, really well regarded, you know, like I say, you know, he gave his creators room to create. And the series I'm talking about, you know, Ambush Bug, that persona was definitely, like, you know, I didn't say exploited, but definitely, you know, made light of. You know, they incorporated Julius Schwartz actually as a character into, you know, these stories or whatever, and to very, very good effect. And to your point, you know, about, you know, how liked he was as a guy, you know, he retired in 1986. But following that, you know, DC Comics, you know, in almost an unprecedented move, appointed him two different things. They appointed him a goodwill ambassador for DC. Basically, like, you know, if ever there's a public event, we're, you know, rolling out Julius Schwartz to be the face of DC. And then also, you know, a title, like I said, I've never heard, you know, anybody else refer to this, editor emeritus. Basically, you know, even though he's retired, at any given point, you know, he can walk into DC Comics office, he's going to have an office, and if he's got an idea for a project, you know, it too will be considered. And one of those projects that was considered during his retirement is actually something that kind of hard to find these days. But, you know, if you find one, you know, pick it up because they're very, very neat. Is something called the DC graphic novel. And this was before the age of trade paperbacks. What these were sort of like harder covered, you know, magazines or whatever. And they were comics adaptations of a lot of the old sci-fi stories that Julius Schwartz, you know, had brokered during his days, you know, in Solar Sails, you know, so like, yeah, like Ray Bradbury stories, and then even some more like, you know, like modern, you know, sci-fi thing like Harlan Ellison or like Robert Silverberg. Yeah, their works were adapted, you know, at Julius Schwartz's, you know, request in his magazine, in the DC graphic novels. So yeah, very, very cool dude. Well respected in the industry, you know, I'm reading down, you know, a list of some of the honors that he was awarded. 1962, he won the Alley Award, we've talked about before, for best editor. In 1972, I think the Alleys were replaced by Shazam Awards, and so in 72 he won that for a superior achievement by an individual for bringing the Marvel family back into print. Let's see, he won the 1981 Inkpot Award. In 1985, he was named as one of the honorees by DC Comics in the company's 50th anniversary publication, The 50 Who Made DC Great. And then in 1997, he was awarded the Raymond Z. Gallen Award for Outstanding Contributions in the Genre of Science Fiction. I shared that award with the writer Harlan Ellison that we just mentioned. Mm-hmm. So just an amazing talent. Like I say, you know, 42 years in the industry, you know, probably affected DC Comics more than, you know, any other presence. You know, we talked before about Gardner Fox, you know, the writer and how he shaped that. All that, you know, was done under the editorial purview of Julius Schwartz. You know, like I say, just a lifelong career of, you know, amazing ideas and really helped define, you know, the DC universe, you know, as we see it today. He actually passed away in February of 2004 at age 88 from pneumonia, believe it or not. But that being said, like I say, you know, will be remembered, you know, throughout the history of DC, you know, both in the stories we've read and, you know, little asterisk here, the stories in which he appeared. You know, we've talked before, yeah, like we just mentioned Ambush Bug and, like, you know, how he was a character there. Well, that was just the latest, you know, in a long run of, you know, Julius Schwartz appearances throughout DC history. you know, he appeared in Flash number 179 in a well-remembered story called Flash Factor Fiction. And we've talked, you know, before about Earth 2 and Earth 3 and Earth A and B and C, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, this, you know, was the story in which the concept of Earth Prime was introduced, which, you know, corresponds ostensibly, you know, to our Earth, you know, basically where you and I exist and, you know, and where Julius Schwartz exists. And so the little twist of this story is that Barry Allen, you know, Flash, you know, is hopping around, you know, dimensions or whatever, and somehow winds up on Earth, and he's like, he has no idea how to get back. So he's like, he figures out what it is, and he's like, oh my gosh, I exist as a comic book character here. I should go see the editor of Flash Comics. So he goes to see Julia Schwartz, and like, you know, there's this weird scene where, like, you know, Julia Schwartz's secretary is like pinging him. She's like, I have a Mr. Barry Allen here to see you. And Julia Schwartz is like, get that nutbag out of the office or whatever. And so, but he comes in and convinces him that indeed he's a Flash. And Julia Schwartz is like, this is amazing. He's like, Gardner Fox is always talking about these weird, like, parallel worlds or whatever. This is the first time it's real. And so he winds up having to go to the hardware store and buy all these parts so Flash can make a cosmic treadmill and like transport himself back to Earth. It's a crazy, crazy story. But yeah, so Earth Prime first appeared there, but then later on, of course, you know, as everything does, it also appeared in JLA, a story written by a guy named Kerry Bates, you know, incorporated himself and you know, LEDS Mag and, you know, another writer. And then they both work for Julia Schwartz, you know, so Julie, of course, you know, made the obligatory scene in there. And that's where that ongoing joke I mentioned before about the bean soup.
Yeah.
So they're mocking him there about, you know, his love of bean soup. One of my favorite appearances of Julia Schwartz in comics is actually Superman number 411 from 1985. It was actually a surprise birthday present. They had prepped a standard issue of Superman, basically, you know, like Superman's fighting Lex Luthor, that type thing. Mm-hmm. And they had been throughout the month, you know, all the creators, you know, bringing it to Julia Schwartz for editorial sign off. But in reality, what they were doing, that was just a cover, they had prepped another story in which the Earth One Julia Schwartz, you know, appears to Superman. And he's like, he's actually not an editor. He's just like a down on his luck guy, like a hobo type thing.
Uh-huh.
And Superman finds out that he's dying, this guy or whatever. Oh. And so, but listen, he decides he's going to transport him to Earth Prime to merge with the healthy Julia Schwartz, you know, who's the editor of DC Comics, and thereby, you know, they would continually inspire each other, and then Julia Schwartz would have a direct connection to Earth One. Great, great story, and actually kind of a bit of a tearjerker, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, was just, like I say, you know, a latter-day Julia Schwartz appearance in comics. The very first one, surprise, surprise, we're going to cover tonight.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. I know I told you we weren't going to cover any stories tonight, but and probably, you know, this is going to be like an, we talk about asterisk. This is going to be an asterisk for our show because there's no real magic, you know, inherent in this story, unless you want to talk about the magic of creativity or something like that. But no, it's a story from Strange Adventures, number 140, from May of 1962. So right, you know, in our era that we're covering, it's a story called The Strange Adventure That Really Happened. And, you know, to tie it into everything that we do here, script is by Gardner Fox, with pencils and inks by Sid Green, who we've only ever seen as an inker on JLA, but, you know, he was an artist in his own right. Colors unknown, and letters, actually, apparently, by Sid Green himself. I didn't know Sid Green did any lettering, but but so, yeah, I thought it'd be kind of neat. It's just a short story, but you want to go ahead and take a look at that?
Yeah.
Yeah? All right, cool. So let me go ahead and pull that up. All right, so the cover, like I say, doesn't have anything to do with the story inside. You know, Strange Adventures is an anthology title, and there's like, you know, three or four different stories in one issue.
Mm-hmm.
The featured story here is apparently the prisoner of the space patch. We see an astronaut, I guess, floating above the street as, you know, people are trying to, you know, prod him with brooms and like throw lassos around him or whatever. And the dude's like, the astronaut's trapped inside the patch of space that suddenly appeared over Earth, and there's no way anyone can reach in and free him. This is clearly a Gardner Fox story. So let's go ahead and turn this open and find the story that we're looking for. There's Prisoner Space Patch, you know, it's page one. It's it's some nice Murphy Anderson art, actually. This is Gardner Fox, Murphy Anderson. Flip a couple pages. We see a Palisades Amusement Park ad, full pager. Ooh, and hearkening back to our very first episode, you know, a bit of more surprise for you. Science says you're wrong if you believe that. ... So let's review some of our science facts here, you know, courtesy of Gardner Fox. So water is composed of a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen gases. But science says you're wrong if you believe that, because water is actually a combination of these two gases, not, in fact, a mixture. Did you know that?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so going back to seventh grade chemistry.
Yeah, I think so.
So, and science also says you're wrong if you believe that a burn is dangerous in proportion to the depth rather than to the area covered. That's not true. Apparently, a large area surface burn is more dangerous than a small area deep burn. So I say, so like a bigger burn is
because it opens more your skin,
dangerous than a small burn that goes deeper. What's a small burn that goes deeper?
I don't know, like maybe like from a curling iron or something. I mean, still
you
a
stabbed yourself
burn.
With a curling iron or something?
Yeah, like really hot curling iron.
Whatever. So, and I don't even know what they mean by dangerous. You know, this is very ill-defined.
Yeah.
But science, apparently, you know, in 1962 said you're wrong, that if you believe that the rate at which hair grows is increased by cutting it, you know, we see cross-section, I guess, of three different types of hair, you know, blonde, European, West African, and Chinese, and these cross-sections are magnified, apparently. 175 diameters, and science tells us that while hair grows more quickly in summer than in winter, really, and perhaps more rapidly at night than during the day, it's a popular fallacy that cutting the hair increases its rate of growth.
I didn't know that.
Nora. So, and science also tells us that we're wrong. You know, if we believe that a sound wave that strikes our ears from 6 feet away is one-third as intense as the sound heard from 2 feet away, that's apparently incorrect because the intensity of a sound drops as the square of the distance. Thus, the intensity of a sound wave 6 feet away is only 1/9 as great as it would be from 2 feet away. Now, I know for a fact that's not true. I think that a sound heard from 6 feet away is only 1/3 as intense as the same sound heard from 2 feet away. I'm going to hold fast to that belief. Science. Like, what? Like, who would believe that at all? Like, you know, unless you're, like, you know, dealing with sonics or something like
yeah,
that.
I don't know.
And if you were, I think you probably know the science behind it.
Right.
You know, but Gardner Fox, I think, you know, feels it's important to alert us to you know, the square of the distance as related to sound.
Thanks, Gardner Fox.
Thanks, science. So, all right, so let's turn the page to our story, the strange adventure. Ooh, even in the strange adventure logo, mm-hmm. That really happened. And we begin with a little inset headshot, you know, of a fellow. Who is this fellow? Well, let's listen to our narration. My name is Gardner Fox.
Hi, Gardner Fox.
I'm a writer for National Periodical Publications, publishers of Strange Adventures. Recently, I wrote a story about an invasion of Earth from outer space. In my story, I figured out a way to defeat the aliens. But then, when my story came to life and the alien invaders appeared, I couldn't remember how I defeated them.
Uh-oh.
As, we see you know, Julius Schwartz, you know, haranguing Gardner Fox at his desk. Fox, you just wrote a story about those alien invaders, and you described how Earth found a way to stop them from conquering us. What was your solution? I can't remember, says Gardner Fox, is scrambling. So we begin, you know, apparently a flashback as, you know, Fox tells us, things were normal when I walked into my editor's office that fateful April morning with a new science fiction story in my briefcase. Let's go, Gardner. Let's go. We got a busy schedule. Sid Green will be popping in to interrupt us, so let's have your story.
This is so weird.
It's so meta, right? Okay, Julie, says, you know, Gardner Fox going to his little briefcase. It came out fine. It won't require much editing. Seconds later, however, things got decidedly unnormal as, hey, says Schwartz, what's this, an April Fool's joke? All these pages are blank. What? Says Gardner Fox, looking over. But stunned, I stared down at a dozen empty manuscript pages. I distinctly remembered last night when I had proofread them for errors. There had been typewriting on them. I wrote the story, typed it, says Gardner Fox, all confused. Well, what was it about? Says Schwartz. Surely you can remember it. I felt ridiculous, says Fox to us. For the life of me, I couldn't remember anything about that story. He says, flailing. Says Schwartz. Must have been a real exciting story, all right. Listen, you always keep carbon copies of everything you write. Call Linda. Ask her to dig it up. I called my wife Linda on the phone, but these yellow sheets are all blank, Gar. This is why she called him Gar. Why'd you staple so many empty pages together? I was plenty confused by this time, says Fox, and a little frightened. How could such a fantastic thing happen? This is everything about the story has been erased from my mind, you know, says Fox in the scene. As the door opens, another dude pops in. Julie, the radio in the production room, sounding off about Earth being invaded by an alien spaceship. More April Fool's jokes, says Schwartz. This time from Ed Eisenberg, the quiet one. Ed Eisenberg, you probably don't remember, but like a long time ago, I think maybe in our first episode, we were reading a letter column. Somebody had written in about Green Lantern's, you know, costume being the wrong color. Mm-hmm. And Ed Eisenberg was the production manager haranguing the printers for getting it wrong. So that's a very peek into DC offices here. So automatically, you know, Gardner Fox goes on. I stared out the window, and what I saw made something click inside me. He looks out and sees, that spaceship! It's exactly the way I described it in my lost story. It's really, that's the way you're concerned about when a spaceship's in the sky? As all this is going on, artist Sid Green strolled in as the radio in the production department, which usually played soft music while the gang worked, was blasting away with a special announcement. Hi, Julie, my story ready? Asked Sid. Never mind that. Now listen. People of Earth, we come for the planet Arleon of the star-sun Spica to demand your surrender. We have no wish to destroy you in a devastating attack, so we suggest that instead of our attacking you, you attack us. We will destroy your mightiest weapon so you can understand how you cannot possibly harm us.
Good idea.
Yes, let's get right on that. My gosh, says, which one's this? Fox. It's hard to tell. This is a bunch of, like, you know, four dudes in business suits. Mm-hmm. But my gosh, says Gardner Fox, that's the exact dialogue I wrote in my story. I remember now that the aliens came from Spica and a planet I made up called Arleon, but I can't remember what happens next. As Green walks away, just, you know, shaking his head. Why did I ever become a science fiction artist? But Julie, since I was telling the truth, Gardner, remember that Flash story you wrote, Flash of Two Worlds? In it, you said you originally wrote the Jay Garrick Flash stories because you were mentally tuned in to his world. As the editor's note says, see Flash of Two Worlds in the September 1961 issue of The Flash. That's right, says Gardner Fox, but what has that to do with this? Maybe that's what happened here, says Julia Schwartz. You must have mentally tuned in somehow to these invaders, learned what they were up to, but since you were writing a story, you thought you'd had a creative inspiration. Narration from Fox continues, says, while we've been talking, the armed forces of the United States took the aliens at their word. From the Bombark missile base at McGuire Air Force Base, a nuclear warhead hurtled toward the alien spaceship.
Because it would have happened that fast.
So as we stared from the 8th floor window of the Golden Skyscraper building, is that where they work? is that National Periodicals in the Golden Skyscraper building? Look, says Julia Schwartz, there goes an atomic missile. You can see that through the window. Just as I wrote in the story, says Gardner Fox, every time I see something new happen, I remember writing it, but I can't remember ahead. Oh, and a convenient excuse. Yeah, this is the exact story I was going to write.
Sure, I wrote it.
So from the starship, a beam stabbed outward, enveloping the missile, obliterating it. That beam, says Gardner Fox, is precisely as I described it. It's like reliving a dream. Uh-huh. Again, the aliens spoke to us. Again, they used words I'd already written. You saw our demonstration, and you must understand how helpless you would be before us. Save lives. Surrender. We will give you 10 hours to make up your minds. How could the aliens and invaders have learned everything I wrote, says Gardner Fox, even to the very words in which I demanded Earth's surrender in 10 hours? How indeed could they have discovered what I wrote, you know, says Gardner Fox, to us? Well, later, I was to learn that as I was about to start writing that story, the aliens from Arleon were out of sight behind the moon. We were seeing flashback, you know, the aliens, like, hiding out behind the moon. We must be certain the Earth people have a powerful enough weapon with which to give our own weapons their firing power. If they realize that we have no fuel to power our weapons, they could defeat us easily. We have to depend on them to shoot at us so we can shoot back at them. It's clever. And these aliens look very green-haired, yellow-skinned, very, you know, just like 1950s sci-fi movie. You know, just with little masks or something. So we continue, you know, as these weird-looking aliens, big bug eyes now as they turn, we say, we can travel through space on stellar energy, but we can't use it to activate our weapons. To do that, we need cobalt. Earth has plenty of this metal and will give it to us after they've surrendered. I just realized that my aliens, these particular aliens, sound like the Dr. Fate newsreel announcer. Yes. Maybe he's an alien.
I noticed.
Aliens have been among us since the 40s. when the Earth people fired us, the aliens continue, the energy from their weapon will be absorbed by our inhaloscope. The inhaloscope will instantly transmit this energy to our weapon and will blast the Earth missile as they're peering at, Gardner Fox, you know, at his typewriter, pipe in mouth.
Undershirt on.
Yeah, right. So Gardner tells us that the inhaloscope was then lowered onto Earth. Editor's note tells us that, as I found out later, the inhaloscope could only operate on the surface of a planet. Wait a minute. How's there an editor's note in Gardner Fox's dialogue?
Like, clearly it's been edited.
By Julia Schwartz. Yes. He's like, I don't like what you're saying. So it had been lowered onto the Earth by a gravity beam and surrounded with a radiant electromagnetic field to escape detection. Wow, he just pulls off all the stops when he's actually in a sci-fi mag. He's like, yeah. I don't need to worry about it. So to make certain of their knowledge of Earth weapons, the aliens ran through them via a tape recorder. Look, says the alien, an Earth writer is putting our entire invasion plan on paper as a story.
Earth writer?
We can't destroy him since we have no fuel for our weapon, but we can't permit him to publish a fictional account of what we intend to do. So the aliens turn to one another on their intricate machines, and when I went to sleep after finishing the story, wipe all knowledge of the quote-unquote story from his mind, then eliminate the typewriting on his manuscript pages as well as the carbon copy. Fortunately, our erasing machine,
yes.
Whatever, erasing. Works on stellar energy, and, you know, not only are they alien, but they're also familiar with carbon copies.
Yes, I noticed that, and erasers.
Yeah, so now, Editor Schwartz was desperately trying to help my memory function. Well, how do you work the story out, Gardner? All you gotta do is tell me how Earth managed to beat the invaders, as always happens in our stories. I'm trying, says Gardner Fox, I'm trying my best, but all I draw is a blank. I'm going to call Washington, says Schwartz. This may be preposterous, but on the off chance that you did work out a good solution to the problem, the authorities should probably hear about it. He's going to call Washington. He's like, I think my writer can, you know, think up a solution if he tries hard enough.
But he can't.
Yeah, so Washington, it tells Fox, you know, was definitely interested. Within 3 hours, a trio of Pentagon officials stormed into the editor's office as we see Fox, you know, holding his head, desperately trying to think. This is the army guys come in. This is General Frederick Herron, Fred, editor Julius Schwartz. Just for your edification, I think this name, Frederick Herron, you know, mm-hmm. the general, I think this might be a play on words. One of the writers in Julius Schwartz's stable of sci-fi guys was a dude named France Herron. We don't read a lot of like Mystery in Space and like Strange Adventures, so we didn't read any of his stories or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think this might be like a nod to one of the other writers in the office. Yeah. So glad to know you, General, says Schwartz, you know, glad handing. I'll fill you in on what's happened while Fox is trying to remember. Think. He's doing this little like Winnie the Pooh thing. I suggest we get Fox back to his den where he usually writes and hope the association of a familiar setting will help jog his memory. Excellent idea, says the General. Meanwhile, I'll remain here and keep in touch with Washington. I'll check with you by phone. So an hour later, you know, says Gardner Fox to us, I was back in Yonkers, pounding away and hoping that as I typed, my recollection of how the story ended would come to me. But nothing seemed to help. I've typed the whole story right up to date, says Fox. I'm stuck now. I can't remember how I worked it out. There's no way. You can't give up, says Schwartz. Listen, what do you do when you're stuck for a good solution to a problem? So what he does is begins to pace the room, as I always do, says Fox. I talk my story out loud. Sometimes I even talk to Yaki there, my Mina bird.
That's a good name for Mina.
It jabbers back at me, little words and phrases. Yaki bird, jabber jabber, words and phrases, says was a Yaki. The same idea struck us both at once like a bombshell. That's it, the bird. Talk out your story, Gardner. Maybe it'll repeat a key word or phrase that'll make you remember. So I talked to that bird until my tongue was sore and my mouth was dry, but all I got was... Aliens from Arleon, a beam to destroy a bombard missile, 10 hours to surrender. You know, Gardner Fox is like desperately talking to the bird. 10 hours to surrender, 10 hours, 10 hours. Then the telephone rang. I'm talked out, says Gardner Fox. That stupid bird never says what you wanted to say when you wanted to say it. Schwartz picks up the phone. Who? Oh, Fred Herron. No, General, nothing yet. But just then, Red Herring, says the minor bird. Red herring, says Gardner Fox. That's it. Now I remember everything. Those are the key words, but I couldn't remember them. The bird mistook the name Fred Herron for the words I spoke to it, red herring. Hold on, General, says Schwartz on the phone. I think we might have something, as Schwartz tells him. The aliens have fooled us with a red herring, something to distract us from the real facts. Their weapon has no fuel. It can't shoot unless we shoot at it. The real danger is the inhaloscope hidden in Carson's woods. inside of 30 minutes, a bazooka squad located and finished off the inhaloscope. As we see, dudes firing bazookas in the woods. It's the best way to, you know, explode that, apparently. As they fire with a ba-room.
They made an exhaloscope.
Yes, an ex-inhaloscope. So shortly, you know, we see, you know, Gardner Fox and Julia Schwartz, you know, standing there on Fox's lawn. There goes the alien spaceship, back to where it came from. When we destroyed their inhaloscope, they realized their trick had been exposed, says Schwartz. Whew, says Gardner Fox, that's a relief. Well, I better get back and finish that story, now that I remembered how it ended. Hold on, says Schwartz, that story's no good to me now. Within hours, every paper on Earth will have printed what happened. Since our strange adventures won't be on the stands for 3 more months, everybody and his uncle will have read it by that time. Get busy and write me another story, fast. You'll have to be satisfied with having saved Earth in real life, as you so often saved it on paper. And you see, you know, Gardner Fox all, you know, hangdoggedly, you know, heading back to his typewriter, hands in pocket. The end. As, you know, also the end, you know, for our Silver Age. But, you know, very, very appropriate wrap-up, I think. You know? We got to say, you know, a comic representation of, you know, Gardner Fox, Julius Schwartz, and Sid Green, and, you know, Ed Eisenberg poking his head in as well. You know, but yeah, very, very cool story.
Yeah.
Is Bird Live? I don't think we're going to do any rating on that one, right?
Oh, well, I mean, of course, the bird would definitely live on this one.
Oh, maybe it'll push our ratings up. and actually, that's a pretty good segue. You know, one of the things I want to do, you know, as we're wrapping up, you know, remember back in like episode 12, how mm-hmm. we took a look at, you know, all the different aspects of our podcast and so on and so forth. I was thinking we might, you know, revisit that, you know, like as we went through there, that's been another, what, 16 episodes. And, you know, we've, you know, you've had Bird Live, you had Bird Die, you know, so I thought you'd maybe be interested in like how we're currently tracking.
Yeah.
Let me pull up our stats here. All right, so in episode 12, we were ranking, I don't know if you remember, we were at 65%, I said, yes. You know, because it was just a barely passing grade. Well, from that point, you know, we began, you know, a bit of an upswing because we entered into, like, you know, that Zatanna story arc,
yep.
You know, and you liked all those stories or whatever. So it brought us up to about 70 and change, I'd say. But then immediately following that, we took another downturn because we went into sort of, you know, zany Haney land. You know,
we
did like, what do we do? Like an Eclipso story, the Rawman thing. And then that might have been when we did the... Brave and the Bold thing with Batman and Eclipso, which, you know, like,
yeah.
So we just had a run of things that you weren't enjoying. Then again, you know, and this goes back and forth. It's almost like a ping pong thing. Like, I think, you know, maybe unconsciously I structure it like this, because following that, we then went into a rise when we did all the Spectre stuff. You know, you really kind of dug that, you know, with one notable exception. You were not a fan of Mr. Percival Pop.
No.
The super cop. let's see. After the Spectre, we went down again. And I attribute that once again to Haney. But then also there was that weird Gardner Fox JLA story where he got like all peacenik. You know, like peace, man. Real peace.
Real peace.
So, but finally, you know, right from that point, we began like, I think like a 4-episode rally. Three or four or whatever. Maybe 4-story rally. Because it was the... Spectre, right, the final one, the Ghost of Ace Chance, and then we had the Death of the Six-Sided Son, Stanley's Monster, and then a 4-story, Felix Faust. From that point, you loved all of those, and, you know, and that brought us up. So our final ranking, you know, as of episode 28, we are currently at about 67.5%, you know, plus. So basically, you know, 2 out of every 3 stories, you know, you're digging.
Cool. So we're on the rise.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure that's going to go, you know, with that trend, you know, as we enter into the Bronze Age, you know, those stories, like I've said before, are a little bit more mature and, you know, a little bit more narrative focused. Like, you know, these things tend to be, you know, very self-enclosed. We're getting into more story arcs where there's kind of like a sense of progression, you know.
Oh, okay.
So I think it'll be something you're more familiar with. And then and hopefully that'll translate to, you know, live birds flying away. let's see, what else do we want to do? Since this is the, you know, the final episode of, you know, this arc, I should have been doing this all along, really, you know, and maybe I'll start posting these in the show notes as we go forward. But I do want to take a moment, you know, at least verbally and acknowledge all the music we've
mm-hmm.
been using.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to do that?
That'd be a good
okay.
idea.
I have that all written down in a little sheet here. Just give me one sec. All right. And I should probably give, you know, a standard disclaimer that, you know, all these works are the property of, you know, whoever.
Somebody else.
Yeah, you know, the composer or whatever, and we claim no rights, and, you know, we're only using this. You know, honestly, we probably shouldn't be using as, you know, much music as we do. But I'm pretty sure that, you know, you're allowed to use snippets. As long as you don't play a whole song, as long as you, like, you know, raise your voice over it such that it can't be, like, ripped for, you know, reproduction or whatever, I think you're fairly safe. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we're going to get sued by all these people. But in any case, let's cover our bases by giving them credit. So let's see. Episode 1, we had That Old Black Magic by Ella Fitzgerald was our, you know, intro and exit music. And for a while, I thought that was actually going to be our theme song. Like, I used that, you know, for our demo, and I thought, you know, oh, maybe we'll use it. But then when we got to episode 2, I'm like, nah, I think it doesn't quite fit. Let me go with something a little more thematic. So for that, you know, I used the Soldiers Chorus from the opera Faust. It was performed, I looked it up, just by a group called the French Chorus. But we didn't use that music, you know, for the outro because, you know, within the body of that episode, you know, we saw the ad for Palisades Park.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, you know, introduce you to that song. So our outro music, you know, that I put on after the fact was Palisades Park by Freddie Boom Boom Cannon. But written, I don't know if you know this, by Chuck Barris, the guy from The Gong Show.
Really?
Yeah, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind guy. Yeah, he actually wrote that song. Let's see, episode 3, that was our Mark Merlin, you know, supernatural detective episode, so I thought it'd be appropriate. We used the intro and outro music from the old TV show Unsolved Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, episode 4, that was Eclipso and then Mark Merlin, you know, becoming a superhero or whatever, so we used the Changes by David Bowie. And,
mm-hmm,
and that was sort of appropriate because that was right around the time that David Bowie had passed away.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a little bit of a tribute there. Episode 5 was our Earth 1, Earth 2, so I used the intro and outro music to season 1 of Sliders. You know,
which also worked.
Yeah, very like multiple earthy type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, episode 6, you actually found this song for us. You know, I was kind of like hard pressed to figure out a Dr. Fate song, and you found an old musical from the 60s called Kismet, and there's a song from that, you know, simply called Fate, performed, you know, I guess from the cast album by Howard Keel, who I know his claim to fame, actually. You know, so apparently, looking at it, he was a Broadway actor back in the day. But I would know him as Jock Ewing from Dallas. He was actually JR's father on that show.
I never watched it.
You never watched it? No. You know, but yeah, very, sort of a very deep voice. You know, he kind of reminds me of like Thurl Ravenscroft, the guy who does like Tony the Tiger, and like, you know, you're a mean one, Mr. Grimm. Yeah, very, very similar type voice. Let's see. We had another Fate episode, A Hand of Fate, you know, by the Rolling Stones was our theme for episode 7.
That was a good song.
Then we went into Johnny Thunder, you know, not such a great character, but two pretty cool songs. We had episode 8 was Thunderstruck by AC/DC, and episode 9 is Johnny Thunder by the Kinks. Let's see. Episode 10, you know, we were, you know, bidding farewell to, you know, both Mark Merlin, and then on a personal note, you know, that was also, we just come back from, you know, Lash's funeral.
Yes.
So sort of a tribute, we, used the song, Bye Bye Life from the movie version of, Bob Fosse's All That Jazz, and as performed by Roy Scheider and Ben Vereen. Very appropriate, you know, to our friend Lash. Very just, you know, sort of extravagant and, you know.
Super kitsch.
Super kitsch, yeah, he would have loved it. Let's see, episode 11 was Best Friend by Harry Nilsson, you know, otherwise known as the theme song to Courtship of Eddie's Father. An old, like, I don't even want to call it a sitcom. It was a bit of a comedy-type TV show. Bill Bixby was a single dad or whatever, and, you know, he basically instructing his son in the ways of life, you know. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was, you know, kind of fit, like, Stanley as Monster.
Yeah.
Let's see. Episode 12. I was hard-pressed to find something thematic about, like, recaps or whatever, but then for some reason I just thought about, like, you know, it just came to me, like, almost like, you know, just like a flash of inspiration or whatever, you know, the old 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, like from Sesame Street,
yeah.
You know, and like, because that goes up to 12 or whatever. And it has that really sort of like, you know, like stark beginning where it's like 12. Yeah.
So, it's almost creepy. The way
it's almost creepy, right? Because you're sitting in silence and all of a sudden that kicks in. And that, believe it or not, guess who performed that?
I don't know.
You know, it's believe it or not, the Pointer Sisters.
Really?
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like that.
It doesn't, yeah, but like, you know, it was like 70s Sesame Street or whatever. I think a lot of different like bands were doing stuff for Sesame Street back then. I remember seeing like, you know, Paul Simon on that back in the day and that type thing.
Huh.
So yeah, very cool. Let's see. Then we went into our Zatanna run, and a little bit obscure. I actually found this on YouTube, but back to back episodes 13 and 14, you know, the first two parts of Zatanna's Search, I used a song called The Backwards Song by a, I don't think he's a, like, I mean, certainly professional musician, but I don't think he's like, you know, a signed musician, a guy by the name of Rob Scallon. And what it is basically is he plays a song forward on the guitar, but then figures out, you know, what the words would sound like backwards, and then sings them backwards, okay?
Like Zatanna.
Like Zatanna, exactly, yeah. And then for the next episode, he then takes that self-same song and then flips it such that he's now singing forward, but then the music is backward, you know? And so that's the backward song, and then in parentheses, forward.
Uh-huh.
So the exact same song, but like one goes forward, one goes backward.
Neat.
And then we wrapped up Zatanna with "Going Back" by the Birds, and you know, also sort of thematically similar. It's going back, but that's also sort of like coming of age, you know. And so we had seen Zatanna's growth, and I thought that, you know, sort of appropriate.
Right, she was coming into her powers.
Yeah. Straight Out on episode 16 was just a theme of Batman, Neil Hefti, you know, almost everybody knows, na 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 na, Batman. And then for Earth B on episode 17, it was John Belushi and the Blues Brothers, you know, off of Saturday Night Live, actually doing King B.
A buzz.
That's right. And, you know, I thought that appropriate for, yeah, twofold. Number one, Earth B, and then number two, because the villain in that was Queen B. So,
yes.
Blah, blah, blah. let's see. Episode 18, another Stanley and his Monster, and kind of obscure song. I never heard this or whatever. I just found it while doing a search called Batman, Wolfman, Frankenstein, and Dracula. It's by a Canadian band called The Diamonds. But, you know, thematically appropriate and also of the age, you know, just sort of kitschy type thing.
I really like that one.
You dug it?
Yeah, I had never heard it before, and that was just different enough.
Yeah, me neither. Let's see. Then we entered into our Spectre, section, and I don't know why I thought of this. You know what it is? I think I was looking for songs about death and resurrection or whatever, you know, to be appropriate for the Spectre, and I happened across one of Radiohead's earlier songs called Street Spirit Fade Out, you know, which is basically about, you know, death and that type thing or whatever, and that song didn't quite fit, but I kind of got it in my head. I'm like, you know, Radiohead in general kind of fits the vibe of the Spectre, you know. And as I began, you know, looking at the episodes we were going to do and, like, you know, some of the Radiohead lyrics, I actually found a handful that, like, you know, fit it kind of well. Uh-huh. So, yeah, episode 19, you know, I used Airbag, you know, because it had the line about, like, you know, I'm coming back to save the universe and, like, yeah. You know, so, yeah, it was
perfect.
Yeah, it was very, very good. We took a break from the Spectre stuff, obviously, for the Darwin Cook episode 20. And from that, just straight out, I used the theme to the animated version of New Frontier. But then in 21, 22, it was back to Radiohead for the Spectre. Reckoner, you know, just a fantastic song for episode 21.
I like that one a lot.
And then Everything in Its Right Place for episode 22, because that story was all about, like, keeping the two Earths, you know, apart from, like, you
right.
know, colliding
he's
or whatever.
Like, you know, extended between the two planets.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it was a nice, you know, sort of, like, confluence that I used, you know, Radiohead for each of those. And, you know, who knows, maybe going forward we'll loop back around and Street Spirit might be appropriate at some point. let's see, episode 23 was the Superman theme, but not from the cartoon. Like, you would suspect, listen to it, oh, that must be the theme of the cartoon. It's actually not. It's from same year, 1965, but it was, like, a... an album that DC Comics put out with some, like, you know, record company or whatever, maybe Peter Pan Records or something like that, with just a bunch of different superhero songs. So that's it's just called Superman Theme, done by the studio group. You know, so I have no idea what that is. Let's see, episode 24 would have been Enchantress, and so I used the theme to Bewitched, but not the one from the show. The theme song to the TV show Bewitched actually has lyrics that were never used. So I found a version of that mm-hmm. with the lyrics, by, Steve Lawrence. And then maybe it was because that was in my head or whatever, but our very next episode, you know, with the death of the six-sided son, I remembered that Steve Lawrence had done a cover of, Soundgarden's Black Hole Sun.
Oh, is that how that happened?
That's what that was, right. So episode 25 was Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet doing their cover, and then the outro was Soundgarden themselves, you mm-hmm. know, doing the same. Back to Sesame Street, you know, for episode 26, you know, R.E.M., you know, the one of the latest in, you know, a long line of musical guests on Sesame Street. They did a parody of, you know, their song, you know, Shiny Happy People. It was Furry Happy Monsters. You know,
it was
fun. It was, yeah, R.E.M. off of Sesame Street. Let's see. Last episode, because, you know, there was, you know, I'm the real Felix Faust. No, I'm the real Felix Faust.
Yeah.
You know, I took the theme from the old, you know, game show, To Tell the Truth, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, keeping in line with our timeline, I took the one specifically from, you know, that, the, you know, 1966, 67, you know, so mm-hmm. it fit the era.
Yeah.
And then this episode, you know, will be The Carnival Is Over. And, you know, it might, as I say, you know, as we enter our Bronze Age, maybe have a corresponding song. We'll see, you know, on the flip side.
So you already have something in mind.
Maybe I do, maybe I don't. And that's by a band named The Seekers. You would know them from Georgie Girl. It's probably
right.
their biggest song. So yeah, like I say, you know, everybody who listens to this is probably zoned out 10 minutes ago or whatever. But like I say, you know, just the credit where credit's due. So, you know, I thought we would take a look at that. And, you know, something else I wanted to take a look at, you know, is the person sitting next to me here, my co-host and wife.
Hmm.
You know, you have been, you know, a major part of this, you know, as I mentioned at the outset, you know, and, you know, once again reiterated on, you know, episode 12, given our little history here. You know, I'm so happy, you know, that you decided to do this with me. But, you know, as always, you know, during these shows or whatever, you know, we turn it over to you for, you know, a spotlight. What are your thoughts? Are you happy you did it as well? Or are you like, you know, it's like, are you like, oh, thank God we're taking a break. And like, I can't.
Well, you know, honestly, kind of both, you know, cause I mean, in the beginning it was like definitely nerve wracking, you know, because, you know, comics have like such an important part in your life and, I didn't know anything and it took a lot of time to ramp up, or it felt like a lot of time, I guess, in hindsight. We did just start this in January.
Yeah, what do you mean ramp up?
Like, I came in with, like, no knowledge at all.
Yeah.
And it's only because, like, the episodes are so full of, it's not just the story, but, like, you're also going through... And you're explaining what's going on behind the scenes.
Like all the history and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, that's sort of the conceit, though. Like, you know, like you say, you know, you didn't know anything. Well, like I say, you know, part of the the beauty of this, you know, is the fact that you didn't know anything. Like, you know, I've mentioned a couple of times, you know, I sort of view you almost as a proxy for like the non-comic book reader. You know, I imagined it in my mind or whatever, you know, you talk about like they're so important in my life. Well, at a certain point, I'd never read a comic before. You know, admittedly, I started
but
when I was...
But you were a kid.
Yeah, I mean, I started when I was like 14, but same type of thing. You know, you read one comic book and like, you're like, oh, I really, like for me, it was the Legion, right? You know, I really like the Legion of Superheroes. Well, at some point, you know, the Legion travels back in time and, like, let's say, you know, meets the Justice League or something. And all of a sudden, I'm like, Justice League, what's this? You know, I explore that and different aspects. Mm-hmm. And that's how, like, you know, your sort of, like, comic world grows and you get turned on other things or whatever. So, yeah, huge joy for me that you didn't know anything, because then I get to see, you know, like, well, what would a non-comic book reader, you know, latch onto? You know, I was very surprised, you know, some of the things that, like, Mark Merlin, you know, like, never in a million years, you know, and I go, oh, my wife's a Mark Merlin fan, or, you know, like...
Then he got canceled.
Yeah, or, like, Stanley's Monster, you know, like, basically a throwaway humor strip, like, mm-hmm. you know, very, very obscure, like, never reprinted or anything like that. We read it on this show, and all of a sudden, it's like, wow, this has a certain charm to it, you know? The other day, you know, you made a reference to me, just, you know, offline or whatever, you said something about Nth Metal. You know, and I got to tell you, I was so proud. I'm like, yes, you know, the kinks in the armor are showing. She's becoming a comic fan. So, yeah, you know, like I say, it'll take some time. But, you know, if you stick with this, you know, if you like, you know, our next wave, you know, is the Bronze Age. And I suspect, you know, you're going to like that a little bit more. But, you know, it'll come. You know, you're learning little by little, as, you know, as anybody does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, like, when it comes to the Bronze Age, it's probably not going to take me as long, just because I have, like, such a rich history in it now. And
yeah.
Even though it was kind of like an information dump, I think everything's going to, like, settle into place.
Yeah, some of the characters that we'll look at, you know, will be new to you, like, you know, brand new. But we have mentioned a lot of that stuff. Like, you know, when we go forward, you know, like, this is the Teen Titans, for instance. We've seen, like, you know, ads for that or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You know, we'll probably loop back around to that. So you, even if you've never seen it before, you kind of, like, do have a point of reference.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So that'll be cool. What else did you like? Any, you know, like a part of the process, you know, do you enjoy the recording? Did you like, you know, the exposure to social media, any of that type stuff?
The social media stuff was actually helpful for me in particular, because like I'm kind of, I guess, shy, you know, as far as like social media goes, but like seeing you like putting out like your Twitter posts, your Facebook posts, and just like maneuvering your way through like podcatchers and like, you know, you have like a web page.
Yeah.
For...
Well, we have a web page.
Yeah, but I mean, you're doing the work on it.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was educational for me. And then I was able to kind of like follow in those footsteps for like for my own stuff.
Yeah, for your business, right? Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. Like that, we started doing the Twitter for the podcast. And before you knew it, you were doing tweets
now
for your business.
Yeah, exactly.
That's,
yeah, my tweets
awesome.
Are entirely different from yours. But,
we
yeah.
follow each other, though.
So. Yes, I'm the one who doesn't really belong there.
No, don't say that. But no, that's awesome. No, so good. Anything else you learned? Did you, like, I know, like, you know, I do the lion's share of the editing, but you've seen me do some of the things or whatever. Have you, you know, have you taken an interest in any of that? Is this...
Yeah, I'm starting to notice, like, you know, like, what to press when and, like, you know, where to click. But as far as, like, the other thing that I really liked mm-hmm. about, like, the podcast was directly from you.
What's that?
The characters, like how you brought them to life,
oh,
and like you largely did that with your voices, and
yeah.
I'm just gonna, like, you know,
yeah,
put the spotlight squarely back on you, because the Stanley-ness monster, just because you brought that one up,
yeah.
Your voices in that one, I think that's really what made that such, like, you know, so enjoyable.
Well, thank you. Like I say, you know, you in our relationship, you've always had a history of, you know, asking me to tell you stories. Even when we first met, you're like, tell me a story, you know, or whatever.
And
so,
you did.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was a golden opportunity. Like, these were the stories, you know, that I was familiar with or whatever. And I didn't realize, you know, that when I started or whatever, that I would even do voices. Like, honestly, I'm like, you know, the man of 10 voices or whatever. You know, like, I think my first two villains were, like, you know, exactly the same. Simon Magus and Felix. You're like, that's kind of funny. So, like, I wonder...
Can we get to 10?
No, like, yeah, how many do I? So let's say we got Felix Fow. You count them for me, whatever.
Okay.
I'll do. Let's say, so from the beginning, you know, I'm Simon Magus.
Okay.
And I'm also Felix Faust. But we'll count
that's
that
still
as
one.
One. let's see, who else did we do back then? I'm Dr. Fate, right?
Two.
The Yul Brynner. He had I am Mayor, right? That was his villain guy.
Three.
And of course, the newsreel guy.
The narrator.
What's happening to Dr. Fate? Let's see. It's four. As Solomon Grundy hate Dr. Fate because he looked like Green Lantern.
y'all Green Lantern.
Let's see. None of the Justice League heroes I don't do voices for. They're just kind of, you know, heroic in general. Let's see. Oh, from the from villain's perspective. Well, first, you know, obviously the Spectre.
Yes.
You know, but then I was going to say, from a villain perspective, I did a couple different villain voices there. I did, like, Asmodeus, which was blah, 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 you know, yeah. I am Asmodeus. But then I did even dropped that lower for, like, I am Shortan.
So you're up to 8.
Which reminds me of the most horrible voice that I hate doing, which would be, I can't even do it. I am Eclipso.
Yeah, well, okay, moving on. We'll count that as 9.
let's see. Also in House of Secrets, like, I didn't do anything special for Mark Merlin or Prince Ramin, but I did do Mark.
Yes.
Like, my Elsa voice.
So that's 10.
It's my only female voice. So we hit 10. Let's see, but who else did we do? Well, you got all the Stanley's monster group.
Yeah.
You got, hi, I'm Stanley, and I'm the monster, and, you know,
12.
And I'm the ghost of Napoleon.
13.
You know, what's his name? I'm Shaughnessy. And I am Schnitzel, you know, whatever.
15.
That's like a bad one. Let's see, so that's the humor stuff. Did Spectre, did Dr. Fate, Solomon Grundy. Is that all of them? Did I do any other?
I think that's a lot of them.
Yeah, let me think. Zatan, I didn't really do anything. You kind of just have a generic, like, kind female voice that I kind of use for, like, Sheila and Zatanna.
Right.
But I think at one point they're like, I am Allura.
T-Bolt.
Oh, yeah. Well, so the bad Johnny Thunder, like,
yeah.
Hey, you T-Bolt, you know? Like,
16.
Right. Yeah, and so, yeah, I've got a variety of gangster voices, like, hey, what's going on? You know, like, that type thing or whatever, you know. But, like, variations on that. Like,
yeah.
If I need to do multiple thugs, I can, like, you know, change that up. But I was saying, before Zatanna, I did kind of, like, a floaty, like, I am Allura, the you know, ghost of the sword or whatever.
17.
Right. And then I think, you know, I kind of did a weird, for the last Felix Faust story, the dryads or whatever, right? Were they the dryads? The ones that were teasing Hal Jordan or whatever, like, we are magic. And like these all sound exactly like me. That's the funny thing. Is that, like, you know, I'm going to listen back to this and go, yeah, oh, yeah, I do this voice, and I do this voice, and this voice, and, like, they're all exactly the same. So, but I think it's fun, you know?
So you are the man of 18 voices.
18 voices, you know,
yes.
We'll see, you know, and counting maybe, but, you know, we'll see. I got to work up something for Dead Man, actually. He's one of my favorite,
yeah.
You know, characters or whatever. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'd like to, you know, in my mind, I imagine him as being like Mickey Rourke from Angel Heart, but there's no way I can do a Mickey Rourke voice. You know,
so I know some movies will be watching.
Oh, God. So apart from, you know, you enjoying, you know, me on the show or whatever, you know, let's focus back on the actual, like, you know, material, you know, as we went, you know, through all these stories or whatever, you know, obviously, you know, we've talked before episode 12 or whatever. I think we did a big thing about how, you know, in the 60s, you know, these comics are definitely of their time. There's certain themes running through. So once again, as we're wrapping this up, you know, let me put it back to you now that you've seen the sort of, you know, latter half of the 60s. Yeah, I wouldn't say latter half of the 60s. We're not actually even into the Summer of Love. Things are going to get even, you know, more and more relevant, you know, more sixtified, you know, if you want to say. But, you know, from, I guess, you know, 65 through 67, you know, what did you see, you know, for instance, like, we've talked before about, you know, comics and how they're, like, you know, reactive to the culture, how, like, you know, things go on in the movies, for instance, and we talked even in this episode about Irwin Donenfeld coming away going, hey, give me sci-fi, or, like, you know, TV, like, you know, a couple episodes ago, you know, we saw a character that is almost certainly based on Bewitched, you know, and then...
Enchantress, yeah.
Exactly, and then, or, like, you know, for instance, you know, the primacy of Batman, you know, in JLA because of, you know, the Batman TV show. You know, so what did you think about that? You know, how comics were reflective of other things going on?
Well, I think that's a good way to put it. You know, like they certainly are reflective of the culture. Like, for example, like with the space race, you know, like you would just like that was actually going on out in the world. But then it kind of trickles down through the comics and it gets all the way down to the kids who are like, sitting there reading their comics.
Yeah, that's actually a good way to put it. You know, you say it's a good way for me to put it. It's a good way for you to put it. The trickle down. Like, I don't know if you noticed this or whatever, but, you know, all the themes that we see in comics, you know, things like the space race or, like, you know, even like we did the Universal Monsters,
yep.
or whatever, like all those things, you know, kind of have like a lag time as far as like getting to comics.
Mm-hmm.
Like it happens out in the world. And then like 2 or 3 years later, it happens in comics. You know, they're not really the most... time sensitive, you know, as far as like, you know, catching cultural trends. And, you know, for good reason. We've talked before about how these are basically like, you know, adults, you know, 40-year-old men trying to write for little kids. You know, not the most, you know, hippest bunch, you know.
Well, yeah, and actually the story that we just did, like, in this episode, like, really brought that to light because they weren't, like, you know, like 40, 50-year-old men. Like, they're also wearing suits and ties.
Yeah,
and
like, they're all bald and, you know, so... but once again, you know, we're talking about, you know, the upcoming Bronze Age, you know, and again, I keep, you know, playing that out or whatever. But that too is going to change. Like, you know, I think as time goes on, you're definitely going to see, you know, and we even saw, you know, a little bit in just the section we covered from like 61 through 67, you know, a shift toward, you know, an older audience. Like when we first started out, Magic Land. Definitely geared for, like, you know,
little kids.
Yeah, 10 to 12 year old kids.
They called it Magic Land.
Right, exactly. You know, and then we're getting, you know, later on, now all of a sudden, you know, you have people trying to talk, you know, albeit, you know, probably fake, but, you know, hipster lingo and, like, you know, just, you know, people out at cocktail parties, stuff like that. And I think, you know, that was a little bit of a reaction, and we've talked about this before, about the approach that Marvel was taking. Right, you know, their comics were a little more sophisticated, a little more geared toward
street
like
level.
Well, not just street level, but geared toward more like a collegiate audience. You know, like we talked a little bit about Doctor Strange and how it was like infused with like Eastern philosophy and all that. Like, that's not appealing to a little kid, you know, but it is appealing to some dude who's just, you know, a freshman in college, you know, reading, you know, like Jung and, you know, all that type of stuff.
Right, yeah, and as the mind is expanding, you know, and also, not to point out the obvious here, but I mean, little kids were reading the comics, but then, like, they're aging, so the material has to become more sophisticated.
Yeah, and to be honest, this is probably the first time in comics history where that was happening. Like, you know, I think a lot, and certainly, you know, we use Mort Weisinger as an example, you know, he would always say that, you know, every, you know, 5 to 7 years or whatever, you got a brand new audience, because that's the way it used to be. You know, back in the 40s, little kids would read these, they'd grow up, they'd stop reading them, you know? But no, you're exactly right. In the 60s, little kids would read them and then go off to college and keep reading them. And that definitely, I mean, take a look at me. Here I am, 40 years old or whatever. I'm still talking about comic books. You know, that becomes, you know, the new normal as far as fandom. Look at the letter columns. Like, you know, people like, you know, Mike Friedrich or like, you know, Jerry Bales, Roy Thomas. These aren't kids, you know. These are guys like, you know, in their like 20s or whatever, you know, writing in. So, yeah, absolutely. It's an aging audience. So yeah, so that's a theme, I guess, you know, as far as, you know, the age. What do you think about like the gender? I know a lot of the stories that we read were definitely, you know, sort of, you know, heavily geared toward a male perspective.
Oh yeah.
What did you think about the representation of women?
So, for the most part, the women were underpowered, but, there were some standouts like Zatanna, for example, like, she was, you know, we got to see her, not the infancy, but like, I guess like in the teen years of like her coming into her use of magic powers. And then like, she really matures into that. But then like, there was like a weird one, Enchantress.
Yeah. The Enchantress.
Yeah. That was a little strange, you know, she's like in competition with herself. And it was bizarre to me, like how she was okay with that.
She just tolerated her like boyfriend, like hitting on both of her.
You know? Yeah. That was it's really beyond me as to like how she can handle that.
So I, you know, like let's like, even as you're talking, I'm beginning to think, so Enchantress was definitely written by Bob Haney. You know, Eclipso with, you know, Mona Honey, that was also Bob Haney.
Oh, yeah.
The spanking scene in Brave and the Bold.
That was Batman definitely Bob
that
Haney.
Was Bob Haney. So I almost wonder, like, you know, like, so let's just pause for a moment and say, okay, well, how did Gardner Fox treat women? So, like, you know, Gardner Fox had Zatanna, and I'm trying to think of other examples. Well, there's Wendy Harris, right? Our Man's fiance, who, like, she fell under the Medusa mask. Oh, that's another voice. Oh, yes, I'm saying that's another voice I forgot. I'm the psycho pirate, the little bratty voice, right? You know. So, but anyway, but
he was great.
But Wendy Harris, though, how was she represented? No, kind of the old style, you know, more like, you know, so
the man's in charge.
Yeah.
And like that's what I mean when I'm saying the women are underpowered.
Yeah. So I can't lay this all on Haney's feet. It was just a sign of the times, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
But Zatanna, definitely, you know, an exception to that rule.
Yeah. She was like, you know, like puppet master there, you know, pretty cool.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, like, coming into the Bronze Age, you know, are there any other, you know, female characters that are going to be, well, certainly we'll see the Mike Sikowski Wonder Woman I talked about before, how she loses her superpowers and then has to become just like, you know, empowered on her own, like learning karate and stuff like that. So you got that. Wonder Girl, I'm not sure. Like, so we're going to do a little bit of Teen Titans, but I'm not sure that, you know, we're going to see her transformation. She kind of gets a makeover from, like, you know, Silver Age, you know, teenage girl to, like, more like, you know, Maud. You know, almost like Mary Jane Watson from Spider-Man, that type thing. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, how many strong women we're going to see right away. You know, definitely it's a different thing in modern comics, you know, like, well, Black Canary, you know, there you go. There's a prime example of somebody, you know, kicks a lot of butt.
Right.
I mean, she, you know, rides a motorcycle and does judo and, you know, yeah. Like, so, and we're definitely going to see more of her, you know, coming up as well. So yeah, so we talked about age, we talked about gender. I guess another thing, and not so much really in the Silver Age, and I think also reflective of its time, is we didn't see much in the way of race. Like, you know, we saw a couple things that kind of like gave us pause. You know, certainly we skipped over, you know, Hal Jordan's little nickname for his mechanic, you know, Pie Face or whatever. But then we saw some references to, you know, quote unquote Orientals, and, you know, obviously, that's nothing we say nowadays or whatever, but, you know, maybe back in the day that was a completely acceptable term. Like, I saw some of that in the first part of the Zatanna story with Hawkman. Remember, he went to, you know, Mongolia or whatever? And it's just, like, kind of a little bit stereotypical, you know, representation there. Well, Stanley's monster, right?
Not to pick on them.
But, I mean, like, you know, those, the Schnitzel and Shaughnessy, those were, you know, just, you know, cut from the cloth cliches of, you know, Irish and Germans or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, kind of played for humor. So, I mean, you can't really fault it too much. You know, one notable thing, I guess you could say, is that we certainly didn't see any black people. You know?
No.
There's actually, you know, a longstanding reason for that in DC. And I think when we get to some of the Legion stories we'll be taking a look at, we'll get more into Jim Shooter. And, you know, he a couple times tried to introduce, you know, black people, you know, into the Legion. He figured, you know, it's a future, whatever. And was shot down. You know, and so there was sort of a policy in DC Comics that has to do, and we'll get more into this, as I say, in, you know, in our Bronze Age section, but it basically has to do with distribution channels. Like, you know, your company in 1965 trying to sell, you know, a magazine, you know, kids magazine or whatever, all around the country. You're not just selling it in New York, you're not just selling it in California, you're selling it down in Mississippi, you're selling it in Alabama, and all of a sudden, you've got a black hero on your cover. You know, DC, you know, I think feared that, you know, all of a sudden they're going to go, no, we're boycotting this and ship those books back or whatever. You know, so for a long time, they kind of put the kibosh on that. But little by little, as I say, you know, as we get into the Bronze Age, we're going to see that shift. And, but overall, you know, like all these things taken, you know, as a conglomerate, you know, basically what it represented was, you know, a real shift, you know, in American view of themselves, you know, but then specifically, you know, as we're looking at, you know, in the comics, you know, from this sort of idealized, you know, happy days thing where everybody's just, you know, getting along and, you know, smiles and all that, to the more turbulent times that were being reflected, you know, on the TV and so on and so forth. You know, we're definitely getting into, you know, the Vietnam era. We're definitely getting into, you know, hippies and summer love and all that. And like I say, you know, everything's going to lag. So as we go into our next wave, you know, maybe like, you know, 2 or 3 years after the primacy of hippies, you know, we'll see that, you know, sort of begin seeping into the comic books. So with that in mind, you know, let's, I guess, give a little bit of preview, you know, as to what we're going to be covering, you know, when we come back from our hiatus.
Do tell.
Yeah, I will. First things first, as I say, you know, we're going to be talking about the Marvelization, you know, of DC Comics, you know, all these themes that were, you know, ever present, you know, in Marvel once, you know, Stan Lee sort of, you know, led their, you know, renaissance, you know, are going to become, sort of standard tropes, you know, in DC. The continuing, you know, universe building, you know, as heroes meet heroes, tons of crossovers, that type thing. But then also, you know, a more, you know, mature look, you know, at those heroes and the problems facing them. They're no longer going to be, you know, aliens in space and that type thing. You know, there's going to be more like street level type things, you know. I mentioned before, you know, hard traveling heroes, you know, Green Arrow and Green Lantern, you know, heading out in a truck to see America, you know, and we're not going to cover that, you know, that's not really magic or whatever, but that type of transformation is going to hit, you know, a lot of other characters. You know, we're going to see the whole concept of like youth and rebellion. You know, a lot of these stories are going to be infused, you know, as I mentioned. You know,
like with, protesters?
Like, yeah, protesters and like, you know, hippies and just like a real generational gap type thing. And, you know, and some of that is born on the back of the fact that, you know, a lot of this older talent that we talked about, you know, is going to be going to the wayside. There's a rather significant, you know, I don't say purge, but, you know, like marginalization, you know, a lot of these older writers, you know, Gardner Fox and like, you know, John Broome and, you know, even some of the artists or whatever, you know, start getting short shrift. And accordingly, new blood is brought in. Guys like Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, we talked about earlier in this episode, Steve Skeets, Jim Aparo, oh, fantastic artist, Jim Aparo, you're going to love him. And then even some of the, you know, editorial lines are going to be shifting as well. I mentioned before a guy by the name of Dick Giordano from Charlton Comics. Yeah, so a lot of those creators that I just talked about, you know, were brought over, you know, under his, you know, advisement. You know, he was a former editor at Charlton, and, you know, so Skeets and Denny O'Neill or whatever sort of followed him over.
Uh-huh.
Another guy that's going to be huge for our show is a fellow by the name of Joe Orlando, who is started as an artist, actually, believe it or not, I think, on... some of those humor titles, like, you know, maybe Jerry Lewis, I want to say, or like, you know, Inferior Five, I think I mentioned
from
time to time. Yeah, he was the artist there. But in very short order, he's going to become the editor for DC's burgeoning horror line. You know, some of those magazines that we've seen here, you know, House of Secrets, House of Mystery, they're going to have like revivals, you know, under Joe Orlando's hand and really become more like, you know, horror focused titles. As the Comics Code, you know, is going to become relaxed a little bit. And some of those elements, you know, the more spooky elements that have been missing from DC are really going to be brought to the forefront. So let's see, as we go forward, some of the characters that we're going to see, you know, if I had to say it one more time, you're going to hit me, but we're going to start right off with Deadman. You know, he's going to be, you know, character numero uno. But then right on the heels of that, you know, we keep seeing, you know, Spectre getting all his tryouts. Well, he's going to get his own magazine.
Okay, cool.
So, yeah, so for the first, you know, few episodes, sort of back and forth with, you know, Spectre and Deadman, two different flavors of, you know, the undead. We're definitely going to have, you know, a little bit of focus on the teen stuff, you know, because, you know, of course, as these stories are shifting more toward that audience, you know, the people appearing in the comics, you know, are going to reflect that. So Teen Titans, I'm hard pressed to read that many Teen Titans stories because there's so little magic in it, but I think I can, you know, sort of, you know, jiggle it a little bit to kind of like make it fit or whatever. There's a couple like, you know, like ghost story type things. And then there's one character, the Gargoyle, actually is a story I kind of like. So I'll throw that into the mix.
Okay.
The Legion I mentioned, you know, so there have been some magic elements in the Silver Age, but I've held off on that because they're kind of like, you know, one and done. But as we go into the Bronze Age, you know, and Jim Shooter takes the writing chores, there's going to be a huge introduction to the Legion mythos and a major magical character. So I'll use that as, you know, a sort of hub for talking about, you know, magic in the Legion. On the humor side, you know, Stan Lee and his monster has been, you know, our sort of Silver Age, you know, harbinger.
Uh-huh.
I think maybe we'll dip a little bit into... Swing with Scooter, you know.
I've seen those ads.
Yeah, he's a sort of like Liverpudlian guy. So, you know, once again, you know, kind of monster-centric or whatever, you know, tongue-in-cheek. But one of the characters there has like some, you know, vampire elements. So, you know, we'll take a look at that, you know, when we look at our teen stuff.
It fits.
Dawn of the Horror Line, like I say, under Joe Orlando. We'll talk about, you know, Warren Comics, you know, which I mentioned before, you know, was sort of the leader in horror comics, you know. Magazines like Eerie and Creepy and Vampirella, that type of stuff. So we'll talk about, you know, the influence that has on DC. And then you know, hand in hand with that, you know, like I say, the horror hosts. So like Cain and Abel and the Three Witches and all that type of stuff.
Neat.
We saw in the Silver Age, you know, revivals, right? You know, Gardner Fox and Julius Schwartz are doing a lot of, you know, that superhero revival. Well, in the Bronze Age, you know, there's actually going to be some supernatural revivals. Johnny Peril is a character that we... unfortunately, are going to have to take a look at. I'm doing the research for this. I am not fond of him. And, you know, once we get into this, you'll see why. But two people I am fond of, and, you know, we've referenced a couple times here, are the Phantom Stranger and his sort of foil, this fellow by the name of Dr. 13, who's like a skeptic. You know, so the Phantom Stranger is always going around getting involved in like magical stuff, and Dr. 13 is always trying to prove that no, it's rational. There's no magic to it. So it's a
That'd be fun.
Yeah, it's a nice, you know, play off it. So, like I say, that in a nutshell, you know, is a high level look at, you know, what we're going to be covering in our next wave.
Uh-huh.
And like I say, you know, maybe like 6 to 8 weeks. I think, you know, we'll take a break, you know, ramp up, get that all put together and come back, you know, in the autumn. What do you think?
Sounds awesome.
Sounds good. All right. So with that in mind, you know, let's give a quick, you know, shout out to all of our contact information, you know, in the interim, you know, while we're on break. You know, as you catch up on these episodes, you know, and you'd like to drop a line about, you know, this one or, you know, any of the 28 that we've recorded, you can do so at tporpodcast@gmail.com. All of those episodes are hosted, you know, on our website, as Melanie alluded to, which is tporpodcast.com. Probably in the interim, you know, like I've fallen way behind, you know, I'm actually, this is episode 28, so I'm only up to episode 14 on the pictures
for
on
pictures.
Facebook. Yeah. So let me take these weeks or whatever and get that all up to date. You know,
yeah.
I'll do, you know, 14 episodes worth of, you know, so actually I'll probably be posting all throughout this hiatus to Facebook and you can find that at facebook.com/TPOR podcast. I think I'll probably keep an active presence on Twitter, even if we're not putting out, you know, episodes for these next couple weeks. And so you can follow us, as always, you know, at TPOR Podcast. And then if you should happen, you know, across this particular episode where I'm, you know, if you should happen across our last episode where I'm putting out this announcement and want to go back and subscribe to us, you know, you can do so, you know, on iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher or Podcastpedia or any podcatcher, as you now know, of your choice. So with that in mind, you know, we want to thank everyone who joined us over these, you know, past 28 weeks. We hope you had a good time, and we hope to see you, you know, in a couple months on the Parliament of Rooks podcast.
Have a great summer, everybody. Say goodbye.